Well, welcome back, folks, once again to the All Things Africa podcast. This is Chris Wyatt. I'm your host for a breakdown of news and events across the continent of Africa this past week. So join us once more here in All Things Africa. Tonight we'll be reporting on a number of stories from across the continent, including in East Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia, Uganda, Liberia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. So with that, let's get right to the news and events of the week we're going to cover in this week's All Things Africa podcast. First off, it's my very sad news to bring a disappointing story from East Africa, in which Ethiopian forces, part of the Amisom mission, shot down an aid plane over Somalia. On Sunday, the shooting down of a privately owned Kenyan plane in Somalia, with the deaths of all six persons on board the aircraft. Now, the Ethiopian troops who shot down the aircraft were guarding a camp for their forces near Bardale in southwestern Somalia. The flight was a humanitarian flight with medical supplies to help fight the coronavirus, and Bardale was where it was shot down, about 300 kilometers northwest of the capital of Mogadishu. Ethiopian soldiers apparently thought that the aircraft was on a potential suicide mission because they had not been informed about any flight and the aircraft was flying very low. Kenyan officials expressed shock over the incident earlier in the week. The shooting down of the plane comes amid strained ties between Kenya and Somalia. Rather unfortunate news to report on, with the death of six people in a humanitarian flight meant to deliver assistance for the COVID-19 crisis. Shifting to West Africa, interesting news out of Ghana today, where the president has said that a single person apparently infected 533 people with the coronavirus at a fish factory in Tema. Ghana health authorities reported the outbreak at an industrial facility this past Friday. Now, the 533 positive cases represents about 11% of Ghana's total infections thus far, and includes part of a backlog of 921 cases going back as far as April 26th. The new cases pushed Ghana's total to over 4,700 as it fast approaches 5,000 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 virus in Ghana. It now has the highest number of infections in West Africa, surpassing even Nigeria's total. 22 people have died as a consequence of the virus, and 494 have recovered, according to the government. Since the outbreak, Ghana says that it has tested over 160,000 people for the COVID-19 virus. In addition to news about the infection of 533 people at this fish factory in Tema, the president also announced an extension of a ban on public gatherings until the end of May. Schools and universities will also remain closed. Now, this comes interestingly after, on the 19th of May, President Akufo-Addo had lifted some of the restrictions on the two major metropolitan areas of Ghana, in Accra and Kumasi, over concerns what this would do to the economy, the lockdown. So despite the lifting of some more extreme measures, the country is still dealing with the COVID-19 crisis in quite a significant fashion, as you can see. Back once again in East Africa, members of the LGBT community are accusing the government once again of abusing or taking advantage of the Wuhan coronavirus COVID-19 situation to target the homosexual community in Uganda. Now, this story first cropped up at the end of March, but we see this week yet another report on the situation, specifically talking about a breakdown of what actually happened at the event. So there was a video that surfaced. In the video, you see things like the mayor, Haji Abdul Kiyamba, who is the mayor of this place where the shelter was located at, saying, "Who are your parents?" He shouts at them, "Give me your parents' number. Quickly, give it. Rubbish." But when he doesn't get answers, he whips and hits shelter occupants with a 4-foot cane in a very brutal display, as the journalist John Sparks calls it. Then he's caught on a video saying, "Who is in charge here? Tell me about the condoms. Where did they come from? Tell me about you were using condoms for. Who were you having sex with?" And the young man replies, "I wasn't having sex with anyone. Tell us who you were having sex with." Once again, this is from an incident that occurred on the 29th of March, in which characterized by LGBT community as a homophobic attack on a facility offering services for the homeless. Now, for their part, the Secretary for Municipal Information, Vincent Nyanzi, says, "We've been told about homosexuals in our area and we're asking ourselves what to do about it. We've told people we're dealing with it with utmost urgency." Interesting. So the camera keeps rolling as the police and local officials bind the hands of the shelter residents and tie them together in a human chain. And then they frog march them to the police station, tied together like a chain gang of serious, dangerous criminals in an obvious attempt to embarrass, shame, and expose the folks who are at the shelter. It's unfortunate. Additional comments that came from people who were caught on the video: "We would like to see their husbands who rented them such a big house. Our daughters are not married. Why don't you marry them instead of engaging in homosexuality?" 19 people from the shelter, including the director of the charity which runs it, were charged by the police with a crime and then locked up. I do not know the current status of them. I've not seen any additional reports if they were released from prison or not. But the sad part of all this is that the city of Kampala had identified 2,000 inmates that it was going to release from the Ugandan prison service because of concerns about congestion in the prisons and the virus affecting them. So once again, we see a situation around the world where government authorities have arrested people who appear to be law-abiding citizens, and they have put them into prison after releasing criminals, criminalizing the innocent and releasing prisoners. This is a common phenomenon we've seen in many places, particularly here in the United States. It's very disappointing. So the defendant's lawyer, Ms. Patricia Kimera, said the authorities have been repurposing emergency powers designed to tackle the virus and targeting the marginalized group instead, specifically the LGBT community we're talking about here. So Ms. Kimera says that it was a trumped-up charge doing an act that is likely to spread an infectious disease. These are people who are found in a shelter, in a home, in a place they take as home. For me, I still believe that there was no violation at all of any of the rules. Now, this is exactly what I said when I first reported this situation in Uganda, is that the authorities, regardless of what their intention was, how could they possibly make the argument that they were protecting the community when these people were living in a shelter? The argument was that there were too many of them in the building. Well, that's an argument that we can apply to hundreds of millions of Africans living across the continent who are in congested, tight, confined spaces and informal settlements, shacks, and informal housing. The fact that they were in a shelter that was specifically there to protect and help those from the gay community who are marginalized and have no place to turn to is not an excuse for the authorities. The deputy police spokesman for the city of Kampala, Mr. Patrick Oyongo, says that the incident in question was not a raid, but a community initiative to enforce social distancing and stop the spread of the disease. Now, that statement seems a bit hard to buy based on this. He also told Sky News that COVID-19 regulations prohibit dormitory-like facilities, adding unnatural sex is illegal in Uganda, but we decided not to charge them with that. Well, the mere fact that you felt compelled to make the statement about unnatural sex in which you found no one engaging in sexual activity indicates that this clearly was not about people in dormitory-like facilities, but much rather an effort to embarrass and harass this community. Now, if you want to talk about a news story or a political position that is guaranteed to lose you support in virtually every location across the continent of Africa, engage in a discussion about homosexuality or endorse or support homosexuality. I'm simply reporting the news and making a point that the authorities are using their authority, exceeding their authority, to target a community, not making a moral judgment about whether the community is right or wrong, but simply pointing out the authorities are incorrect. Now, more interesting and encouraging news coming out of Uganda is Uganda's parliamentary member, Bobby Wine, the singer, is now singing about the coronavirus. He released a song about a month ago, and here are some lyrics from it. "The bad news is that everyone is a potential victim, but the good news is that everyone is a potential solution. Sensitize the masses to sanitize. Keep a social distance in quarantine." So these are the lyrics from Bobby Wine and Nubian Lee in their campaigning anthem called Coronavirus Alert. This came out about a month ago and already has over 2 million views on YouTube. So the song is really just the latest from a musician who's become an icon, mixing politics and music. Now, Bobby Wine, whose real name is Robert Kyagulanyi, has been an opposition figure in Ugandan parliamentary politics for the past couple of years. As an elected member of parliament, he announced that he was going to run in 2021 for president against the country's long-serving current president, Yoweri Museveni. But over the past few years, he has been the target of government officials and the security services repeatedly. His music has been banned. He's been arrested several times. And he's been barred from holding rallies for his own political party, the People Power Party, PPP. He's also currently fighting a charge of treason, which will make it difficult for him to run in the election next year. And one can only wonder if that was the intent. So back over to West Africa, Liberian journalists are concerned about press restrictions and press requirements that are cropping up in the face of the COVID-19 crisis. So Moussa Kena, the press union of Liberia's secretary general, said that during the Ebola crisis several years ago, that the press had learned to adapt to this and deal with the crisis and the pandemic at the time. But Kenna said that threatening comments from government officials have added more hazards to a very already dangerous job. He says that we are risking our lives moving from place to place, villages, reporting to the people, educating the public about COVID-19. Instead of complimenting us for what we're doing, the government is coming back to fight us. Now, there are several statements in this news story from officials from the government of Liberia that some may find troubling. On the 29th of April, Liberia's Solicitor General, Samia Serenia Cephas, told local reporters the government would shut down news outlets and seize equipment from journalists alleged to have disseminated fake news. Notice the term alleged, not proven. No evidence, simply alleged. To have your business shut down, you nearly be to be accused of doing the task of spreading fake news. Now, we've seen this also in other places like South Africa, in which the government famously came out and said that they would prosecute people for fake news and actually arrested people. In Zimbabwe, we've seen people arrested for spreading fake news, including a member of government. When a government determines what fake news is without setting any standards, it's pretty easy to arrest people. The spread of this sort of authoritarianism across the world is very disturbing. Where are the civil libertarians? Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, other folks who are responsible for people's civil liberties, being advocates for it. Where are you at? Speak up, please. Now, Cephas also said that, quoted, you cannot have 100% rights that you may exercise during normal times. Liberia is technically at war with COVID-19, he means. The government had so far been exercising tolerance. Now, a look at Liberia's constitution, Article 15 of that, says that it protects freedom of expression except during an emergency. Article 86 affords the president power to suspend or affect certain rights, freedoms, and guarantees when a state of emergency is declared. Well, one would have to ask the question, what's the legitimate reason for suspending expression other than the fact that you're allowed to? What is the government afraid of? What is it the press is going to say or cover that the government has concerns about? Now, the point about fake news is legitimate, but you have to make the case. You simply can't ban speech. Not morally, not legitimately, perhaps legally, but it doesn't pass the morality test. It's not right to silence people simply because they say something or report something that the government doesn't like to see reported. That's not why governments exist. They don't exist to protect themselves. They exist to serve the polity. On the same day, the 29th of April, the Deputy Information Minister, Eugene Fanon, told reporters that existing press passes, which the journalists have to move about during the lockdown, would be voided and new ones would be issued. Now that is interesting. On the 4th of May, a couple of journalists were affected directly by this. Rita Yogli, a reporter for the privately owned Sky FM TV, was stopped, and Akoi Bassa Jr. from the Press Union of Liberia, he's Assistant Secretary General there, was stopped on May 5th. And they were told that they had expired passes as a consequence of the government suddenly deciding to issue new passes and putting journalists in the position of making them not following the rules. It's very disturbing to see this sort of news. In other news out of Liberia, the German government is reportedly going to cease its development assistance to Liberia as it is unhappy with the corruption taking place in Liberia. For its part, the government disputes this, saying, for instance, the information minister, Len Eugene Nagbe, told Front Page Africa that our commitment in this regard has been recognized by various bilateral and multilateral institutions, including the IMF and the World Bank. This is evidenced by the IMF's recent statement on Liberia, when it approved a credit facility of $213 million, in which it praised the government's dedication to carrying out ambitious structural reforms necessary to restore macroeconomic stability and put Liberia on a fiscally sustainable path. Now, that's interesting. Nonetheless, it appears that the German government will be ceasing its future assistance to Liberia, but will continue its current commitments. Now, part of the problem here, of course, is if you look at Transparency International, Liberia is ranked as one of the most corrupt countries in its most recent index from 2019. Out of a possible score of 100, Liberia scores just 28 points, which places it 137 out of 180 countries surveyed for corruption. Germany's support to Liberia has involved infrastructure, recovery, health, regional and global projects and programs, including the European Union's Liberia Reconstruction Trust Fund. It's a project that ran from 2008 until this year, with a total of 44 million euros devoted to it. Now, that is a multilateral trust fund for financing large-scale infrastructure projects. So Germany will remain committed to its existing programs, but it will be stepping aside, reportedly, after these projects end in 2022. This is not good news for Liberia. It's not a good endorsement for the current situation. Amid frequent reporting of corruption and incompetence under the current administration, this is not the sort of situation that the government of Liberia needs to be hearing about. Liberia apparently is not alone, according to this news report from Front Page. Also, Sierra Leone will be losing its assistance from the German government. So with that unhappy news, let's shift to something more pleasing. And this comes from the Associated Press. So a Liberian girl has recorded a song about COVID-19. I believe the song will help fight the virus because the song says prevention, says Joselia Kole 9. The voice is strong and the words are resolute. Let's protect ourselves to save our family and our country. Let's stop the public gatherings. Now, Joselia, who's from Banga in the northern part of Liberia, about 180 kilometers away from the capital, was quoted as saying, I believe the song will help fight the virus because the song says prevention. We need to prevent ourselves from coronavirus by washing our hands, not shaking hands, and not sneezing on one another. Well, that's good advice, Josiah. That's really excellent stuff to hear. Now, interestingly about Joselia, she began singing at the age of 3, and this is not her first effort to do something positive for her community. Now, her mother helped write this song, and they recorded it in a local studio and then sent it out to radio stations. It's been getting a lot of play across Liberia since it was released. Now, when she was just 6 years old, with her parents' help, she set up a charity to allow friends to stay in school when their families face financial difficulties. Now, the charity, which is called Build My Future Foundation, or BUFF, B-U-F-F, is currently helping 5 girls and 2 boys in rural Liberia. Francis Kate, Liberia's chief medical officer and one of those on the front line fighting COVID-19, said he was overwhelmed with gratitude for Joselia's effort. Now, that's some very inspiring news. A 9-year-old records a song, gets a lot of play, and it talks specifically about the virus. So here we have Bobby Wine, a famous parliamentarian, member of parliament, musician from Uganda, who's recording songs about the virus to change social behavior and help people get through it. And we have this lovely 9-year-old child from Liberia who's doing the same thing. So that's inspirational, I would argue. Turning our focus to Southern Africa, just more news out of Zimbabwe. Apparently, the main opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change, is now got yet another issue with its situation in parliament. On the 31st of March, the country's Supreme Court had declared that the head of the party, Nelson Chamisa, his leadership of the party was illegitimate and ordered the party to hold an election to replace him within 90 days. Now, a majority of people within the MDC, amongst the leaders, have rallied behind Chamisa, arguing that the leadership issue had been settled when the party held a Congress in 2019 to choose a new executive. I'm not entirely convinced of that. I recall that situation, and it was a bit confused at the time in the aftermath of the sudden, unfortunate and untimely death of Morgan Tsvangirai, the former head of the party, who died from cancer. The MDC said that Parliament, which is controlled by ZANU-PF, had taken sides in its fight to control the opposition. Now, that may or may not be the case, but it certainly is not unprecedented for the ZANU-PF party to interfere in Parliament with opposition parties. For the avoidance of doubt, this means that no MDC member shall attend any parliamentary committee or the sitting of Parliament or any official business of Parliament until such a time as a decision is made. Now, that's a statement from the MDC because the MDC has decided to boycott Parliament because 4 of its members are reportedly to be dismissed over this fight about who's in charge of the MDC. Now, sadly for Zimbabweans, this is yet another example of the opposition party not really being up to the task. The MDC has split 3 times since its formation in 1999, and it's frequently accused ZANU-PF of fanning the fire amongst its ranks. Zanuf, PF for its part, denies that charge. But regardless, it's not a good sign for the opposition to consistently break into different factions like this. When that happens, the opposition will never defeat ZANU-PF, even in a legitimate election. It will prove difficult. Now, moving from the troubles of the MDC in Parliament to an issue that's playing out across the region, according to a report by Columbus Mavunga, who reports that authorities are using food aid to give to recipients based on political affiliation. So the London-based human rights group Amnesty International said that food was being denied to people by ZANU-PF officials if they weren't ZANU-PF members. Now, one person who didn't want to be identified lives about 100 kilometers east of Harare, told The Voice of America that opposition members in the rural community are being treated as second-class citizens. Quoted, the source said, "It's really tough here. Local leaders from ZANU-PF are from ZANU-PF and say anyone who belongs to any other party does not get food aid. They say we must get it from the parties we support." Well, that's not how it's supposed to work. Robert Shavambu, Amnesty International spokesman in Southern Africa, says the pattern of partisan food distribution has been emerging across the region ever since the coronavirus pandemic popped on the scene. Shavambu was quoted saying, "Anyone who does not have the means to make a living must be provided with food regardless of his perceived political affiliation. The distribution of food aid along party political lines is completely unacceptable and is undermining the protection measures that governments have committed to implement to uphold the right to food for everyone." Now, even before these lockdowns took place in the midst of the COVID-19 crisis, Zimbabwe was already in a dire state with 4.3 million Zimbabweans living on food assistance in urgent need of food. Now, to address these concerns or claims, Zimbabwe's Junior Minister for Information, Energy Mutodi, dismissed the Amnesty International report, saying that these are falsehoods. "We disagree in totality with these allegations. We are giving food aid to every citizen who is deserving. We have had red flags raised by community leaders about people who are suffering because of lockdown, who cannot afford to put food on the table. And the Ministry of Social Welfare is inviting such people to approach its offices, and these have been helped indiscriminately." Well, fair enough that the government refutes the allegations. But the challenge, of course, in Zimbabwe is it's difficult to actually report on these, as the government is cracking down on the press there and charging people with reporting fake news when they hear things that they don't like to hear. So that is a challenge. The Amnesty International report also mentions South Africa and Angola as being countries where political affiliation is being used to punish those who are not members of the ruling party. From that rather distressing development of political parties shamefully using, reportedly or allegedly shamefully using food as a weapon against their own citizens, let's talk about something more positive. Shifting to Botswana, right next door to South Africa, this past week, Botswana is one of the few African countries that had not had seen increases in its cases for over a week. And so they've begun a phased return to work, which started at the end of the week. And so the following new guidelines are in place: maintaining a register of employees, visitors, and customers that interact with a facility. In other words, a business must maintain a register. The observance of social distancing, 1 to 2 meters apart, provision of sanitizers and means of washing hands at premises, wearing a face mask, including homemade ones, and denying entry to persons who fail to abide by guidelines. So with that, Botswana has begun to ease the lockdown restrictions, and none too soon for a country that's in grave jeopardy already from losing export earnings from its main source of income, which is diamonds, as demand for diamonds dries up around the world and people are not buying diamonds. So you already have that situation, which Botswana has previously gone through in the 2008-2009 financial crisis. But here we have it yet once again, a situation where people are not buying diamonds. But on top of that, virtually all economic activity had ceased. Now at least economic activity has an opportunity to return, but folks will not be going back to school yet for some time. In other news, very exciting news, very impressive news here, President Masisi was at the airport himself to receive a donation from American comedian Steve Harvey, who donated 7.2 metric tons of medical equipment that arrived in midweek this week. It was consisting of personal protective equipment, which will be used by frontline staff. And the president said the consignment had been donated by our friend Steve Harvey Motusi and his lovely wife Marjorie Lesedi Harvey. The couple were good friends of the country after having recently spent a vacation in Botswana. So that's some more impressive and encouraging news out of Botswana. Taking a look at Namibia, Namibia Breweries Limited is concerned about the prolonged lockdown prohibition on alcohol. The managing director, Marco Venk, said that the prolonged prohibition of alcohol sales have been extended June 1st, and that this has a severe impact on its production revenue, as well as over 300,000 Namibians directly linked and indirectly linked to the formal and informal alcohol trade. Now, that's an astounding figure if it's true. I don't doubt that it's true, but think about that, folks. Country of approximately 2.6 million people, 300,000 people in the formal and informal sector are linked directly or indirectly to the alcohol business. That's a shocking number of people. And if that is in fact the case, the longer that this prohibition on alcohol goes on, the graver the consequences for the wider ecosystem of the brewing process, all those who support it, and all those who work in it and sell its products. 300,000 Namibians, that's a shockingly large number of people tied to the alcohol industry. Now, Wenk says it's very unfortunate that our industry has been brought to a virtual standstill, but we are committed to complying with the directives and are using this time to work with other industry partners to ensure safe and responsible trade can resume without delay. Wenk said the company is not considering retrenching its employees. It has taken other cost-cutting measures, including salary reductions for executives, but the remaining 900 workers at the company have been getting their full salaries. And so that's the situation in Namibia. Taking a quick look a little bit further south, at South Africa. The South African government apparently is interested in helping Madagascar test its herbal cure for COVID-19. Madagascar's president, Rajoelina, is promoting a tea infusion based on the Artemisia plant and praising the benefits in treating the coronavirus. Now, Frank van der Kooi, who is an expert in pharmaceutical science at Northwest University, has said, "At this moment in time, I don't know what that remedy contains, and I'd love to know what's in it, a list of ingredients, so I can test it. That's why I'm quite keen to help our minister do the analysis, because that's the first thing I'll do." Tea infusions based on the Artemisia annua plant only remain stable for a few hours as the active ingredient breaks down, according to van der Kooi. So if that's the case, I wonder how much efficacy this drug could actually have going forward. And finally, news out of South Africa. In late April, Cuba sent 217 healthcare workers to South Africa to help fight COVID-19. Now, in the past, oftentimes we've seen the deployment of Cuban medical workers to Angola, particularly during its civil conflict between UNITA and the MPLA, but also in other places when there have been natural disasters, Cubans have sent medical doctors and nurses to help alleviate the situation. But this deployment looks like it's going to cost the South African government quite a bit of money, according to the Daily Maverick, who spoke to the Economist Intelligence Unit's Mark Keller, who said that this particular situation with these 217 healthcare workers meant that the South African government was going to be charged about 450 million rand for the Cuban medical doctors to come to South Africa. Now, the question raised by this is, does South Africa need these doctors? Why are they there? South Africa has sufficient doctors and nurses to meet its current needs, does it not? And why is it that South Africa is willing to pay 450 million rand to get Cuban doctors to come to South Africa? What is the purpose of that? Why is that money being spent there? That $450 million could be used for grants to help people who are unemployed, can't feed themselves, or to buy food parcels, things like that. Given the small number of cases we've seen thus far in South Africa, country 57 million, it is interesting that the ANC has chosen to take assistance from Cuba. But it's not assistance. It's not grant assistance. You're paying for it. So basically, you're paying contracted services and passing it off as if it's been a humanitarian effort. And that in itself is questionable. So there you have it. Interesting, is it not? So there you have it, folks. Thank you for tuning in to All Things Africa. This has been this week's presentation of news and events from across the continent. I'm your host, Chris White. I hope you enjoyed this discussion of news and a little bit of analysis to go along with it. If you enjoy the podcast, please sign up for it and enjoy this once a week as we put it out. If you are familiar with my YouTube channel, Chris Wyatt Africa on YouTube, you can tune into there and subscribe to the channel and find videos covering news events and analysis from across the continent in much greater depth, along with a weekly live stream show in which we interview guests. And then on top of that, what I call stray voltage or random live streams talking about current events or topics across the continent. This week's guest was Ovigwe Egwuegwu from Nigeria, who is a security expert who talked to me about a whole host of security issues in Nigeria. A week prior, we had Evans Larrabee, who's a commercial farmer, small scale, in Ghana. And this coming week, we're hoping to have someone talk to us about the sheep herding business. If not, we'll be talking to an economist about financing in West Africa. So thank you for tuning in to All Things Africa. We'll catch you here next time. Have a wonderful week, ladies and gentlemen.